Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. President. We are going to do a proclamation because April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and we are going to have a proclamation, but I also wanted to, I invited the Portland Police Child Abuse Team, and many members are here, and I wanted to call up Lieutenant Rachel Andrew and Sergeant Dan Liu to come to the table. You don't necessarily have to say anything, but I just figured I know how shy you folks are. So, and I wanted to also recognize everybody who's in attendance today from the Child Abuse Team, and that is including, as I said, Lieutenant Rachel Andrew, Sergeant Dan Liu, Detective Lori Smith, and you can just wave your hand, Detective Chris Irizarry, Detective Mace Winter, and Detective Eric Carter. Okay. Well, these men and women of the Child Abuse Team intervene in some of the most heinous crimes out there, the abuse of a child. The jobs these detectives and sergeants do every day is demanding, tough, but extremely important work. The long-term impacts of child abuse are monumental. There are far too many children that do not survive abuse, harmed by those who are supposed to protect and care for them. And these members of the Portland Police Bureau intervene and protect children from further abuse and prevent other children from being abused also. They deserve to be commended. It is one of the toughest jobs I think there probably is in the Portland Police Bureau. And I want to say one thing that has impressed me is that the majority of these men and women in the child abuse team stick with it for a long time. You know, many have spent their careers there, and I can certainly understand, in one sense, why one wants to keep working on this issue, because it is so important to so many young people. But I also know it's a tremendously psychological impact. The psychological toll of the cases you work on is tremendous, so I want to thank the team, and we'll read the proclamation in a minute. I just want to also thank you, you know, for your longevity, for your long-term commitment to bringing those responsible for child abuse accountable, but also preventing further children from being abused. And so I really thank you for all your hard work. And now Commissioner Amanda Fritz is going to read the proclamation. I guess I maybe before you read it, did either one of you care to say anything?
Just thank you for your kind words. It's well appreciated. It is a tough job.
Okay. So Commissioner Fritz, please read the resolution.
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. Whereas children are a community's most valuable resource, and whereas physical, emotional, sexual abuse all constitute harm against children, and whereas our community's children deserve to be safe, nurtured, and cared for, and whereas the Portland Police Bureau's Child Abuse Team investigated more than 700 cases of severe child abuse last year, and whereas the Child Abuse Team partners include the Portland Police Bureau, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, the Gresham Police Department, the Oregon Department of Human Services, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, the Fairview Police Department, the Troutdale Police Department, and CARES Northwest. And whereas the City of Portland recognizes the important contribution the Child Abuse Team makes to intervene and prevent child abuse, and whereas the City encourages all Portlanders to have a positive influence on a child, so that Portland's youngest may grow in a healthy, nurturing community. Now, therefore, Sam Adams, the mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, does hereby proclaim April 2012 to be Child Abuse Prevention Month in Portland and encourages all residents to observe this month by honoring the work of the Portland Police Bureau's Child Abuse Team.
Thank you.
Round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the great work.
We have a second proclamation this morning recognizing Awesomeness Day. If our two special guests would come forward and As the president of the council, I get to select any member of the council to read the proclamation. I chose Mr. Awesome himself, Commissioner Randy Leonard. Commissioner Leonard, would you read the proclamation?
That's awesome. Whereas the City of Portland wishes to recognize the launch of the Awesome Foundation in Portland, and whereas today marks the launch of a philanthropic organization aimed at inspiring Portlanders to design, create, imagine, and smile, and whereas 10 local trustees will gleefully donate $100 every other month to collectively award $1,000 to the most promising proposal, rewarding imagination, determination, and altruism with the goal of uplifting and transforming our beloved Portlandia in the areas of art, technology, and social good. And whereas begun in Boston in 2009, the concept of awarding monthly grants to projects that connect communities and evoke new opportunities has spread to cities around the world, all with the same goal, to promote awesomeness in the universe $1,000 at a time. And whereas Portland joins San Francisco, Seattle, Austin, Sydney, London, and Berlin, among others, on this amazing adventure, and whereas we extend best wishes and fortitude to Portland's founding members as they prepare to award their first grant on May 17th. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim April 26, 2012, as Awesome Day in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this day.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome. Deirdre, would you want to start?
Thank you. First, we'd like to thank you very much.
We need your names.
Oh, Deidre DeMeritt and
Leslie Rogers.
We are co-founders of the Portland chapter of the Awesome Foundation.
And I want to thank you. We think that this is a perfect marriage, the Awesome Foundation in Portland, in the spirit of keeping Portland awesome and very weird. I would like to say that we've received 40 proposals so far. For our grants, and they've ranged in the area of micro farms, community-based gardens. I believe we even have a project suggesting Goatlandia, which is essentially a reality TV show intended to be about goats that will bridge communities and bring diverse populations together in Northeast Portland. And with that, I want to thank the city for embracing us, and we are having a launch party on May the 17th. The deadlines for our applications are May the 3rd. As I said, we've received 40, and we would like many more, again, in the areas of arts, social good, and technology. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. Congratulations.
And how could somebody find out more about this program? Could you give us a website?
That's a great question. We have a fantastic website, awesomeportland.org. Very easy to find.
What a great name.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. Carla, I think I got ahead of myself. Now that Commissioner Leonard's here, let's do the roll again, and then we'll move to communications.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Adams?
Quorum is present. We're now going to move to council communications. Without objection, we will hear council item 402 first.
Request of Sarah Lewins to address council regarding maintaining current funding for SUN programs.
Welcome. As with all speakers this morning, we just need your first and last name, and you have 3 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Lewins, and I am the principal of Roseway Heights K-8 School here in Portland. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you in support of our SUN schools. Prior to joining Roseway Heights, I was the principal for 6 years at Markham, so I have great familiarity and clear understanding of the significant benefits the SUN program brings to our students and our families. Roseway Heights has been a community school for the past 33 years, and a SUN school partnering with Portland Park and Recs for the last 12. Being a SUN school is deeply ingrained in who we are as a community. We have almost 600 students enrolled in kindergarten through eighth grade, with over half of them participating in SUN classes each term, and we offer between 30 to 40 classes each week. We also have adults taking classes and have a huge summer program that is highly subscribed to. SUN classes offer both academic support and enrichment, as well as, especially in our case, a very wide range of sports or fitness classes. You are well aware of the clear benefits between strong after-school programs leading to improved attendance, achievement, and for our students, increased fitness. I've brought several letters for you, and I want to share some of those, as I believe hearing the voices of our students is vital for your decision-making. These students' voices represent kids at Roseway Heights, but I am positive they represent students throughout our Sun Schools. This program helps us do a better job with our students, better preparing them for our community, and it's a resource that we can't afford to lose. Dear Mr. Mayor and council members, my name is Deja Charleston, and I attend Roseway Heights School. Over the past years that I've been here, I've attended a lot of Sun programs like chorus and basketball, track and field, and the Girl Project. They've really helped a lot. As you know, our school's homework club is also a part of the Sun program, and from my experience, it really helps. Kids really do get most of their homework done, and I used to get an F in language arts because of missing assignments. But now, thanks to homework club, I have a B, and so far my teacher says I'm the most improved student she's ever seen. So by cutting that tiny little club, you could drop a whole bunch of people's grades just like that. Do you really want to ruin our education? Do you really? You should think about that. Love, Deja Charleston, sixth grade student at Roseway Heights. Dear Portland City Council, as you have heard, after-school Sun classes can be closing, and we need your help. At Sun, I learned how to unicycle, play tennis, do Chinese yo-yo, and sort of juggle. Sun School helps keep kids active, healthy, and smart, too. So could you please help us keep Sun School? Sincerely and hopefully, Alden Robert, fifth grader at Roseway Heights. Dear City Council, I feel that Sun School is very important. Students can do things they would never be able to do during school hours. Because of Sun, I have learned how to unicycle. Through Sun, I have learned many different ways to play dodgeball. Another thing I love about Sun is that you can sign up for classes with friends, and while you're learning new things, you're having the time of your life. I can't imagine what our school, Roseway Heights, would be like without Sun School. It would be like a library without books, a computer without a monitor, the Hunger Games without Katniss. It's a great thing, and I do not want to lose it. Sincerely, Claire Lyons, fifth grade, Roseway Heights. Thank you.
Principal Lewins, is it possible to leave those letters with us so we can send responses?
I have a huge folder for you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And please, we'll send out a response.
Mr. Fritz will answer each one.
Please let the...
We will
answer them. But please let the students know how much we appreciate hearing from them.
That means a lot to them. They actually put a lot of effort into this. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Carla, would you please call Council Communication number 398?
Request of Christine Nagel to address Council regarding Sun program and why it needs to be retained.
Councilor, my wife is Christine. She's home with our sixth child, Spencer. She's asked if I could read a statement in her place this morning.
We'd be pleased to have you if you just identify yourself. And hopefully she'll recover quickly.
Yep. Cool. I do too. Someone has to cook tonight.
Uh-oh.
Me. But anyway, I'm Greg Nagel, and I'm reading for Christine Nagel, representing her today. Before sending our daughter to kindergarten, if you had said Sun program to me, I would have had no clue what you were talking about, and no one I asked knew what it was or what it meant. We enrolled our daughter in her first Sun class when she was five. The class was for mixed ages, kindergarten through second. She was enrolled because she was struggling to make friends at the school. By the second class, she had made a bevy of friends, some who were older and could support her. Being a drama class with scripts that also encouraged her to read, in kindergarten no less. And our entire family, including extended family, have been involved with the Sun for 6 years now, taking classes, making cultural crafts, donating to Season of Sharing and the food bank, stomping our feet and sweating at the community dances, and even teaching classes. Sun provides fun, enriching programs, classes teaching music, foreign languages, carpentry, sewing, Lego robotics, self-esteem, reading, math, and science. Sun also provides tutoring. This alone has made an impact on our student who struggled to do homework at home without turning into an emotional wreck. Next year, we'd like to send her brother to Buckman's Sun program to receive the same support his sister has received that his school cannot provide. When our school needed math and writing support, Sun provided deeply memorable experiences that included stilt walkers, chocolate fountains, debating in togas, and writing new laws and ancient scrolls. I still don't think those kids realize they were doing math or writing. When they're older, I have no doubt that they will devise clever ways to get people to do things because of these magical experiences that Sun has provided. This year, I'm taking a parenting class at Sun that Sun has facilitated. I was apprehensive. Am I a failure as a parent for taking this class? Without a question, it has helped me to understand and relate to my kids better and to have more meaningful relationships with them. It didn't take years for this to happen, just a couple of hour-long classes in the evening, and I will forever thank Sun for that. Over the years, I've seen firsthand the benefits of kids who are matched up with mentors through Sun, including one of our students and his mentor who were invited to Washington, D.C. to attend the National Mentoring Week, where they met with President Obama. Not one single person in this child's family would have ever imagined that that would have been possible. Son made it happen. I've seen families in tears after receiving boxes overflowing with holiday gifts from generous donors. Who arranged all this? Son did. The results were the same with the winter program. I know of one family who had been struggling, not been struggling before, but found themselves days from being evicted because of their series of drastic medical procedures that had drained their savings. Who helped them stay in their home and no one else could? No one else could? Son did. This isn't the only story like this. In a way, I'm glad that Son program is at risk, because it has made me reflect and realize just how valuable Son is and the great impact it has had in our lives, our school, and our community. It is shameful that Son is hacked at year after year when it has proven to be an invaluable asset for the entire community. Yes, schools uniting neighborhoods. That's what Son does. That's what Son stands for. Let's continue to support this. Christine Nagel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Carla, would you please read council item number 399?
Request of Greg Greenway to address council regarding no pass-through cuts to Sun, including at Buckman.
Greenway, welcome to City Council. Sir, you have 3 minutes.
Morning, commissioners. My name is Greg Greenway. I'm a parent at Buckman Elementary School, and I'm here to ask you to protect the pass-through funds for all Sun programs, including those at Buckman. On a very personal level, in terms of how Sun affects my family, I would echo everything you've heard from other parents before me. We're renters in the neighborhood, and I'm really concerned that the kind of education and support that my five-year-old daughter, who's a kindergartner, gets is going to be very different than that my nine-year-old son received going to the same school. As policymakers, I want to suggest to you that you're on very strong ground in supporting the Sun programs. From an economic perspective, having access to affordable and reliable childcare is absolutely essential for working parents. I mean, it very literally, in some cases, is the difference between people being able to keep their jobs or not. From an educational standpoint, Sun really is what I call a recreational learning program. It's a perfect match for park funds. There are 60 after-school classes at Buckman, and they're all tied to educational and academic benchmarks. And kids who aren't meeting academic benchmarks receive daily tutoring at school for free. And beyond the regular classes, Sun also supports and runs a homework club, community building programs like Family Write Night and Family Math Night that we've attended with my family. From a social equity standpoint, Buckman Sun supports more than 200 at-risk children and their families with tutoring, mentoring, connecting people to a variety of social services. They sponsor the Season of Sharing, and they call every English language learner family at Buckman every week just to check in and make sure things are going well. Financially speaking, I want to suggest to you that the investment in Sun is a very good investment of public funds for the city of Portland. The Sun program at Buckman leverages public dollars 2 times over, and in terms of the city's dollars alone, it's many times beyond that. They do this because of the very strong relationships that they have built up over a long period of time with more than 40 community organizations and other agencies. These are the kinds of financially efficient partnerships that we really need in these difficult times, and they can help carry us through budget deficits and carry kids through as we get through these hard times. I want to close with a word about community building. If we're serious about using schools to connect to communities and making them the center of neighborhoods, we really need to coordinate those connections, and somebody has to facilitate those initiatives. And that's a really tough ask for school staff who are already stretched to their limits, but it's something that Sun actually specializes in and could really be a model and a great help as we implement those kinds of ideas that are outlined in the Portland Plan, for example. I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for your consideration. I know that every budget decision has trade-offs, and I hope that you'll consider saving Sun. Thank you.
Sir, thank you very much for your time and for your comments. Carla, would you please call council item 400?
Request of J.R. Sanford to address council regarding Right to Dream 2 as a recreational campground.
Mr. Sanford, welcome.
Morning. My name is J.R. Sanford. Hello. I curiously question the reasoning behind the Right to Dream 2 presence on the private property owned by or private property owned located in 4th and West Burnside, designated as a recreational campground. I saw no recreational facilities there. These are homeless people trying to get serious sleep. Okay, I cannot help but think of all times I was in violation of this ordinance as a little boy when I was camping in my friend's backyard. No one came up and told me I was in violation. And I visited the Right to Dreams 2 site and was pleasantly surprised by the cleanliness and orderly fashion the entire site was in. I was truly surprised. I was in awe by the social atmosphere as calm as the residents were in, and knew it was because the residents had been experiencing safe, restful, uninterrupted sleep that allowed them to enter REM dream mode. Can you imagine being woke up night after night from your slumber and interrupting your sleep cycle? How irritable you'd become even if you're in your own bed. Hey, get up. Let's move on. I was touched when I witnessed a first grade girl named Annabelle pull up with her parents and set up a free soup stand right in front of the entrance of the Right to Dream 2. Then I thought of all the city ordinances she was probably in violation of. You know, open flame, a sign on the sidewalk, you know, no permits. Then I just totally rejected that idea and thinking of all the compassion this little girl had trying to help these people out. And I sent an email to you, Dan. I don't know if you got it or not. And all I ask is the city council of this great city of Portland search their hearts and realize that we are all in this together. Yes, all of us are in this together. And waive the fines levied against the property owners. I ask that you fund their efforts because Right to Dream 2 is keeping up to 100 homeless people safe and off the streets at night. Now we know there was two homeless people that were killed underneath the Morrison Bridge. So I'd like to take the rest of my time in silence for the people that have died because of the homelessness. We are all in this together. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Carla, would you please call council item number 401?
Request of Brian Anderson to address council regarding Sun program.
Mr. Anderson, welcome.
Good morning. Brian Anderson, principal of Buckman Elementary. First of all, this is not the uniform for Buckman. We just happened to dress alike today, so I want to throw that out there. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and want to thank the Buckman families that have testified before. As many parents from the affected school have testified, we urge there be no cuts to city pass-through funds to Sun, particularly to Buckman. Buckman is not a wealthy school or community. It's quite diverse. Because of the major cuts to our budget over the years, we have very few supports in place for struggling students. We're a school of 500 students. 53% of our students live in the neighborhood compared to 3 years ago when I got there, which was 30% were neighborhood. Currently, 47% of our students come from all over the city compared to 70% 3 years ago. 23% of our families, excuse me, back then were eligible for free or reduced lunch. Just this month, we hit the minimum of 40% free or reduced lunch requirements for Title I supports, only to have it raised to 60% nearly the same day. This data really emphasizes that our school's demographics are changing quickly. We do accept all neighborhood children, whether we have space or not. Many families have special needs, and our Sun partnership has been instrumental in supporting them, whether with short-term or long-term services. I think Matt Callahan, who is a third-grade parent, spoke to you, and he said it best when he said, "Once the support and coordination is gone, so goes the well-being of the child." It has been clearly conveyed that Buckman depends so much on Sun for support and enrichment opportunities that cannot be accomplished during the day because of our severe budget cuts. Last week, I had no choice but to make a very painful cut to our elementary arts program, which, by the way, is the only elementary art program of its kind in Portland. We're faced with the loss of two of our three full-time arts teachers who have been with us for almost the entire 22 years. The two art teachers not only help our children form lifelong love of the arts, but they also have been very supportive forces in the lives of all 500 students this year and thousands from years past. The possibility of losing Sun renders us unable to offer supports to students who desperately need help. Diane and our SUN partnerships are fully proactive with their academic support as well as social service needs. I will meet with Diane Meisenhelter, whenever I have students who are seriously struggling in certain areas such as math, writing, and reading, and she will find academic support for these children. If a child has basic service needs such as food or clothing, SUN is right there to offer non-judgmental help and support. SUN coordinated our family math night and our write night, which tied into our school improvement plan. And Diane and her staff are truly all about supporting children. Losing SUN, losing our two beloved art teachers, possibly losing the pool, and finally reaching Title I requirements only to have it pulled out from under us is more painful than I can convey to you. Our SUN program, like our arts focus, is what makes Buckman a healthy, supportive, beautiful place to be for all 500 students and families. Removing even one of them is tragic. Imagine school next year with all of these gone. While we're on the subject, there are more cuts. We're suffering.
I'm sorry, okay, sir.
Thank
if you. Could
you.
Just, if you could
just. And finally, I just want to thank you all for your support. Mayor Adams has been very supportive of our school, and we really appreciate the time you've offered to our families to speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all of our friends here who are testifying on SUN. Parks Bureau has to find $2.7 million of cuts. The SUN school cut, which would potentially mean two programs impacted, although they have not been selected, has received significant public opposition and is not something which I think my colleagues feel strongly about either. So we are looking for alternatives of ways to meet these cuts. We have a $17 million deficit in our budget. None of us want to balance our budget in the backs of children, and we are all enormously proud of the work that the SUN School community does with kids. So thank you for your time and coming and sharing your testimony.
Thank you.
We're now going to move to time certains, and we have a 9:30 time certain. Carla, would you please read Council Item 403?
Do you want to take care of the consent agenda?
Let's do that. Yeah. Does anyone want to pull any item from the consent agenda?
We have any 407 and 411 were requested by the mayor's office.
So 407 and 411 will be returned to the mayor's office?
407 will be continued to next week, and 411 is pulled for discussion.
Okay, that will be moved to the last item on our calendar.
Okay.
Does any member of the public wish to pull any item? Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
This is the vote on the consent, right?
On consent.
Yeah, aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye. The agenda passes. We have a time certain at 9:30. Carla, would you please read Council Item 403?
Accept the Portland Design Commission State of the City Report.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a pleasure to bring forward this morning the Portland Design Commission's State of the City Design Report. The first item of business, however, is to thank the dedicated volunteers who serve on this commission. This commission meets a minimum of twice a month and often for multiple hours as they review land use cases and provide advice. They are a hardworking group that includes Gwen Milius, the chair, David Wark, the vice chair, Jane Hansen, Andrew Jansky, Ben Kaiser, David Keltner, Catherine Schultz. So if you could maybe just stand up if you're here or in the audience. We just want to acknowledge you and thank you for all your hard work. This commission will be presenting, and this is their first ever report to council. So it's a big deal. We'll try to make them as nervous as possible. No, we won't. We will make it as easy as possible. But they have, this, even though this is their first report to council, they have been in existence since 1979, providing leadership and expertise on urban design and architecture. This report comes to council at an important time for the city and its design overlay districts. As the Portland plan wraps up, critical work begins on the more technical, comprehensive plan and quadrant plan efforts that will further enhance city design tools and standards for the city. Additionally, as the economy begins to improve, development pressure is increasing, and Portland's older neighborhoods and commercial corridors are under pressure from long-time established long-time established entitlements that yield large infill proposals. So, and these neighborhoods deserve the appropriate protection and predictability and quality of infill that meets our density goals and inevitable growth. This is especially important as the economy improves and development picks up. We'll hear some concrete ideas on how we're all how we do this in the brief presentation to follow. And please let me know if you'd like to move a more thorough briefing from staff, and we can provide that to each council member or the mayor. So to start things off, Bureau of Development Services Director Paul Scarlett will start off, and then Commission Chair Gwen Milius will take the helm. Thanks.
Okay.
Paul.
Good morning, and thank you, Commissioner Salzman. Good morning, Commissioner Leonard, Commissioner Fritz, and Commissioner Nick Fish, presiding as president. It is with great pleasure that I'm here today for the Portland Design Commission State of the City Design Report. I'm here in a similar fashion as I was back in early March to support and endorse the Design Commission's report, as I was for the Historic Landmarks Report. A large part of livability in a vibrant city is having well-designed projects that respect their neighborhood context. This can especially be challenging in infill situations when dealing with stark differences in scale and intensity, as well as livability concerns. My attached memo to the Design Commission's report points out a number of focus areas that the Design Commission and BDS staff has been addressing real quick, having to do with a two-track design review process, rezoning split zone blocks, and exploring thresholds for mandatory design reviews. Those are spelled out in more details, and I'm sure Gwen and David will go over those in more details. But I do want to express that I'm very appreciative of the collaborative work between my staff and the commission members in working together to administer the city's design regulations. I especially want to express my appreciation to design commission members for their many hours of volunteer time and energy given to this important work. And these hearings can be long and involve a lot of controversy, and I appreciate what each design commissioner brings to the table. Thank you all very much. The timing of this report is very important as development activity we're starting to see is picking up, and at the same time, BPS is beginning to update the city's comprehensive plan. So it is critical that BDS and the Design Commission get the regulatory tools we need to do the job that you, the community, expect of us to get well-designed quality infill in Portland's neighborhood, as well as new projects in design zones throughout the city of Portland. We hope City Council will find a BPS project in the upcoming budget to update the Portland's community design standards in the zoning code to get better design projects. BDS staff will participate with BPS on the comprehensive plan update, including specific projects dealing with design compatibility and transitions. We are also supportive of revisiting the triggers for mandatory design review. The community design standards don't always work well for large-scale projects, and we would get better results with mandatory design review. If I could take a second and have disclosure, I actually worked on those compatibility standards when I started almost 23 years ago. So obviously times change and projects change, and we need to update our regulations. So this is a very critical and important effort that I'm certainly very familiar with and support. So as BDS works with the Design Commission, BPS, and community stakeholders in this coming year, we look forward to addressing these planning and design challenges. With that, I will turn it over to Design Commission Chair Gwen Milius for further remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Council, for having us here today. So as he mentioned, somehow we've managed to exist for 33 years without making this face-to-face presentation to you. We're glad to finally do it. I won't be walking you through the full 33-year history today, just a snapshot of what's happened in the last few years, the Commission's overall approach to projects that we see and some of the challenges that we're facing. My fellow commissioners were introduced. I'd like to fill you in a little bit more about the walks of life that we all come from. Sometimes it's perceived that we're all architects, and in fact, it's not the case. I'm the commissioner at large, and as such, I'm actually not an architect and not a building design professional at all. I have a marketing company, but I have a avocational interest in architecture and urban design, and it was my volunteering through neighborhood associations that got me to the Design Commission. So it's just, I just want to let other volunteers and neighborhood associations know that there's a place to go from there. My vice chair, David Wark, is an architect, but he's also our representative from the Regional Arts and Culture Council. We need to have a member from the Arts and Culture Council on our commission, and he is fulfilling both those duties well. Jane Hansen is a landscape architect and a principal of Lango Hansen Landscape Architecture here in Portland. Andrew Jansky, who would like to speak at the end of our presentation, is a civil engineer and a hydrologist, which is an interesting area of expertise to have on our commission, and he's also now our longest-serving commissioner. Ben Kaiser is a developer of residential and commercial properties. David Keltner is a lead designer at THA Architecture, and Catherine Schultz is a principal at GBD Architecture. The Design Commission recommends the establishment, amendment, or removal of a design district to the Planning and Sustainability Commission and City Council. We develop design guidelines for adoption by City Council for all design districts except historic districts and conservation districts. And there should be a map in front of you that shows the different design districts in the city, and that includes both historic and design districts.
Here comes the map.
Right. We review major developments within design districts, except those projects involving or located in historic or conservation districts or projects that are themselves historic or conservation landmarks. We review other land use requests assigned to the Design Commission, and we provide advice on design matters to the Hearings Officer, Planning and Sustainability Commission, Historic Landmarks Commission, the Portland Development Commission, and to yourself, City Council. I've been on the commission since October of 2006, when the real estate market was quite different than it is today. I joined the commission at the end of an era of many long hours preparing for hearings and still more hours working through them. My first hearing as a newly minted design commissioner was 8 hours long. In one single hearing in 2007, our commission reviewed 1 million square feet of new development, representing hundreds of millions of dollars in economic impact in Portland. Fast forward 18 months, and it was as if the well had run dry. There was a graph in the packet submitted to you that illustrates the dip. From 2009 to 2010, there was a 66% drop in type 1 and 2 cases, which are reviewed and approved at the staff level. And from 2007 to 2008, we saw a 73% drop in type 3 cases, which are the ones that came to us for review. So we went from 22 type 3 cases in 2007, which was our peak in the last 5 years, to 6, 7, and 6, respectively, in the years following. We had 14 in 2011, which is a clear indication to us that money is surely, if slowly, returning to the real estate development market. The numbers aside, the notable thing for me is that having seen real estate development at its recent zenith and nadir, the underlying principles we use to approach projects remain the same. Our thinking does evolve, but these bedrock ideas still apply. We strive to bring our review process the following: clarity, predictability, consistency, and fairness. I gave a brief explanation of our thinking on each of those core values in my report to you, and I'm happy to expand on them if need be, but I want to make it clear to City Council that to a person, our commissioners take our responsibility to offer each applicant those four values as part of their design review experience quite seriously. We have several challenges before us, which I'd like to outline with you today. These are issues that come up again and again, whether the economy is good or bad, and they are topics that we discuss internally on a regular basis. Whether it's a fabric building or an iconic project, will we always want this development around for 100 years or more? This is what I call the issue of forever. Of course, even the best buildings aren't with us forever, but I will be looking at many of the buildings we approve for the rest of my life, and my kids and grandkids probably will be too, so it's a forever of sorts. Given that, we need to be sure that the developments we approve are built to last, fit into the city's fabric, and have something to give back to all of us. We ask ourselves these questions: is it compatible to the neighborhood? Is it inviting? Will it stand for 100 years, and will we want it to? When we review a building, we care about the execution of details, how all the pieces of the building come together, especially on the ground floor, where most of us will interact with it. And we believe that in a pedestrian-friendly city, it's important to consider how a building looks up close, not just the impression you get of it driving by at 30 miles per hour. Whether a building is meant to fade softly into the background or be a landmark in its district, any building in a design district should offer high-quality materials, carefully considered details, and a measure of transparency and openness to its surroundings. When building materials are constantly changing, their quality and permanence can be quite fluid. The take-home message here is that we are asked to consider a lot of newfangled building products that may or may not be time-tested. We've also seen a lot of building products evolve as energy codes, market forces, and manufacturing processes change. As a commission, we end up needing to maintain the subspecialty of knowledge regarding the components that go into a modern building, and it's quite a lot to keep up with. What is compatible? We are asked to consider whether or not new buildings are compatible with the design district in which they are proposed. The challenge before us is that some of our design districts are neighborhoods that don't have a strong vocabulary to draw from, or perhaps have a design vocabulary that the surrounding neighbors are hoping to correct through design review. So in the face of a hodgepodge of design styles and widely varying degrees of quality, how do we determine what's compatible? Matters could be made a little more complicated, at least from the standpoint of the neighborhood associations, in that in many of Portland's design districts, a parallel development track allows building owners to use community design standards to design their project and avoid design review altogether. These standards, which Paul knows were written in the 80s, to the extent to which they are still compatible with the area that they apply to, is subject to heavy debate right now. We have been approached by a number of concerned citizens about what is increasingly viewed as an outdated loophole in Portland's development code. A whole other theme that I think we're seeing a lot of right now is the question of social and economic equity as a factor in design review. I think it's a fascinating time to be involved in planning conversations in the city of Portland because of a new emphasis on social equity. It's refreshing to see the city consider their plans for development in terms of the overall health of its people. I applaud this council for their foresight in making those issues so integral to the new Portland plan. The Design Commission is increasingly addressing the question of social equity and economic viability and their nexus when it comes to design review. For instance, in the eyes of some, quality and permanence in materials could mean something very different in Central City than in the outlying districts. Development teams and design districts outside the Central City sometimes report to us that their markets can't support the higher-end building materials so often required downtown. Others feel that to hold development teams in emerging neighborhoods to lesser standards than the Central City has the potential to erode effective design districts. Ultimately, I think we err on the side of giving the districts outside the Central City the best run for the money that we can get. We believe that when these neighborhoods accepted light rail lines and increased density, they expected, in return, buildings that are more humane, built to last, and friendly to their neighbors. But there's a balance to be struck, and it isn't always easy to find. Here are some challenges in this arena. Affordability and quality, allowing for middle ground. This problem doesn't come as a shock to you, but budget is always a factor in getting something built. Some commissioners have expressed concerns that the act of design review, because it adds to development costs, has given Portland better-looking projects, but has taken away a measure of affordability. So the challenge before us is to balance pushing the quality and permanence of materials on these projects while understanding budget demands, especially for projects that are trying to offer affordable rents. Ultimately, we have to ask ourselves, can the same project be done better for the same budget? If the answer is yes, it's our obligation to push for the better design. But the truth is, sometimes better design costs more, and we must again strike a balance between helping projects see the light of day and protecting the long-term property values and interests of the development's neighbors. How do we make zoning and density work in existing neighborhoods? Between the recent boom in condominium development and the recession-fueled drive to build more apartments we're living through now, we've uncovered a zoning issue that has laid dormant in several Portland neighborhoods for years, the split-zoned block. The Design Commission often sees homeowners who discover for the first time that the property on the other side of their fence has high-density zoning when a new apartment complex is proposed. Their shock over the idea of a 4- and 5-story building looming over what they had considered private airspace is palpable. They are further dismayed when they realize that their property doesn't share a similar zone, and therefore they can't enjoy the financial gains of redevelopment themselves. Development teams, even when building completely within right and without requests for modifications, often struggle to provide meaningful buffers between their projects and their neighbors. Now, when we have the opportunity to review proposed zoning changes in a design district, we look very long and hard at places where split zone blocks occur, and we've had some success at mitigating areas where zoning was likely to create these inequities. However, we do think that the city needs to address other areas where split zone blocks exist to help create a more comfortable fit between new, denser development and the existing fabric of neighborhoods. We were hoping that more of these issues would be addressed in the Portland plan, but because they weren't, we will be pushing to help with this issue in the update of the comprehensive plan. Sure, go ahead, please.
Just a note that this is probably the most controversial aspect of the cases that come before the Design Commission are these backyard developments, as Gwen outlined them, and probably also the one that's most appealed by neighborhood groups. And so we have some suggestions that Gwen will follow up with on how those might be mitigated to some extent.
So another challenge that we face right now is how to make development more humane. We've seen a lot of apartment buildings lately, and these projects have opened up discussions on issues that don't necessarily fall within the rubric of design guidelines, but do touch on areas of broader interest to the health of the city. For instance, what can be done to make our housing stock more humane for its inhabitants and friendlier to its surroundings? We have recently requested that development teams consider for their tenants access to light, adequate ventilation, including cooling, and this is especially true in situations where apartment buildings are maybe up against a freeway, and the idea of using your open window to cool your apartment is, you know, kind of gross for people. More generous ceiling heights in apartment units, especially in a city where the acceptable size of living units is getting smaller. Ultimately, we want this transition from density as a concept to density as a reality to be humane and workable for all of our fellow citizens, so we're reviewing projects with a view to that goal.
Can I just ask on that issue, are you hearing any concerns about parking and not requiring parking?
Absolutely.
It was interesting that that wasn't in your report.
Well, the issue with parking is that that's a within right thing. And a lot of times in Central City, you're not required to put in parking. If you do, there's a maximum sometimes. It's not an issue that we really can address as a design commission. We can talk about how the parking lot works, if there is one, or how it doesn't work. We definitely hear from neighbors about parking impacts when there's no parking proposed.
Right.
Rare to see a project that doesn't have any parking incorporated. I think the truth is that they're hard to pencil, and they always have to
have some parking. Projects that are adjacent to light rail, streetcar, are particularly sites and projects that are not required to have as much parking as other areas.
A lot of, on any kind of transit street, and I realize that some of them aren't in design districts, but I'm hearing a lot from neighbors on Division, for example, of a large apartment complex with no parking.
Right.
And do you hear that those kind of cases?
Right, and Division isn't covered by design reviews, so we don't necessarily hear from a lot of these neighborhoods where you would kind of expect that there would be, but there isn't. And so I live near a lot of those developments, and I have friends and neighbors ask me, well, did you let that building get built? And I was like, well, you know.
So that's something else that we need to look at.
It is something else we need to look at.
Right, and
thank you.
At what point do we consider expanding design districts and or having exceptions for buildings of a certain scale?
Yeah. Parking garages is another topic, actually, Commissioner Fritz, that you mentioned. And I know that that's on the horizon for us. There are a group of people in the West End districts that are getting organized around the design and placement of parking garages.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very concerned about having, you know, full block garages sort of plonked into these districts, and how are they going to fit, and will they work, and can they work? And so I've opened our commission to a dialogue with these groups early to discuss their concerns and to see if we can kind of come up with a framework for thinking about these projects.
That's terrific, and I agree. When we do the comprehensive plan and the zoning code maps and language, that'll be
there's a lot
looking
to discuss
there. Participating in those discussions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So these are my concluding remarks. We really do appreciate this opportunity to present to you. We request the following of council. As the economy improves and development begins to pick up again, we hope City Council will consider funding an update to Portland's community design standards. These outdated standards need to be reviewed in the face of the myriad zoning adjustments and changes to the built environment that weren't envisioned when they were first developed. We also hope that you will join us in advocating for better equity in some of Portland's rapidly changing neighborhoods by helping us eliminate issues such as the split zone block, especially in cases where a significant difference in property value is effectively created by the split zone. We hope you will open the opportunity to consider design review's future role in our city, either through the expansion of design districts or considering some sort of threshold that would trigger design review anywhere in the city. So what I'm talking about is when you have, you know, a major project that has impact on a neighborhood that, like I said, feels like it might have design review but doesn't. Maybe there's a way to say any project with a value over X million dollars should have some sort of design review. Finally, we hope that the City Council understands that we are a resource for the city. We're here to serve, even beyond our routine design review work. Commissioners regularly advocate for better design on steering committees, advisory groups, and more informally with development teams who seek our guidance. When a matter comes before you and a design insight might play a role, please feel free to call on us to help as early as and as often as needed. I should note that this includes efforts to shape common areas such as streets, sidewalks, bridges, parks, and other public facilities. We deeply appreciate the opportunity to weigh in on these projects. We greatly appreciate this opportunity to play a part in shaping a stronger Portland, and we thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Chair Milius. David, did you have anything you wanted to add? Or?
Well, I did want to add one or two little things about part of our responsibility is also reviewing non-standard improvements in the right-of-way. And as Commissioner Leonard, with his Portland Loop project, had come before Design Commission, there were a few tweaks about some materials and little details that we hopefully felt were improvements. And then also we kind of brokered a conversation between the Portland Loop and Portland Parks and Recreation Department to site these projects in a way that is beneficial to both. So. And we also give advice and feedback to other agencies such as Portland Parks and Rec and Portland Bureau of Transportation and TriMet on all of their infrastructure. And we feel to some degree we've been helpful in elevating those to world-class status.
So. And I was actually going to point that out. It was very helpful for me to come before the Design Commission and have the discussion, and you've been helpful in citing a more appropriate location than what we would have originally come up with on our own, including the most current proposed one on Jefferson and Park.
Okay. I'm glad it's helpful. You know that's a very difficult needle to thread for you guys. The loos require so many pieces and parts to fit in just the right place. So
yeah, it's been the biggest challenge has not been constructing them or designing them. It's been locating them. It's just been a headache.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
For a variety of reasons.
We appreciate the opportunity to add to the mix. I know it's not always.
It's been helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you again for your hard work.
Actually, I was going to give one of our fellow commissioners, Commissioner Jansky, an opportunity to just say a few words. He is on his way. Okay, come on up.
Are you signed up? They'll follow you.
Okay, great. I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you for your hard work.
Your former chairman thinks he's still running the show here. Carla, do we have anyone who signed up to testify?
We have three people who signed up.
Let's bring them all up.
Okay. Andrew Jansky, David Keltner, and Lloyd Lindley.
You can have the center.
No. David.
Lloyd, you want to kick us off?
Oh, sure. Oh. Thank you.
Is David?
He's not speaking.
He's not speaking.
Why don't I go and you can go.
Okay.
You can wrap it up.
Okay.
I'm Andrew Jansky, and I wanted to thank the council for an awesome opportunity to serve. I'm definitely proud to have served on commission for 8 years. And, you know, through boom and bust, we've had many night till 11 p.m. Some of those cases in that little graph where there's a lot of cases that I served through that with Lloyd. So we spent a lot of time together. So it's also a sample of probably what it's like to be on council, a small sample. And so working for Literal Peanuts, you know, I've probably received one of the best experiences of my life on this. And it was an honor to work with skilled commissioners present and past. I've learned a lot from them. And the city is definitely a better place through the design review process. Maybe staff can show you the before and after images sometime if you want to see really what we can do. But probably the most amazing thing is the city staff that supports us. They're hardworking, dedicated. They encourage development while meeting the design guidelines. and it really demonstrates the awesome leadership of the group all the way up. So just thank you again.
Thank you for your service.
Thanks.
Thanks, Andy. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. And
need
thank
your
you.
Name, Lloyd.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lloyd Lindley, 3005 Northeast 16th.
Don't need your address.
Okay. what's that? It's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you, Council, for having the Commission here and hearing their state of the Design Commission address. When I became involved with the Design Commission, Mayor Katz gave us a charge. She said, we want you to raise the bar on design in the city of Portland and wanted to see more appeals coming to City Council. Well, we saved you from that. I think we only had one or two appeals that actually came to Council during my term. I'm also the chair of the North Northeast Quadrant, which is updating the Central City 2035 plan, and have been on the periphery of the comp plan amendment that's going on. I just want to recognize the people here today and those who came before us. They're all volunteer professionals and citizens, and they bring a huge amount of experience. And the important part of their experience is the values of this city. Because the design guidelines, as you probably know, are subjective. They're not standards, and they complement all of the other commissions that we have, as well as the Title 33 code. And so the Design Commission, in a way, is the steward of our city values of the built environment and what Portland looks like, especially when it comes to our visitors that come here and try to learn from Portland and what we do. And I would like to say that with the Planning Commission, Commissioner Fritz was on the Planning Commission at a time when this city was evolving in a very big way. The Design Commission and the Planning Commission working together were instrumental in the whole notion of sustainability in the city. And so I would just like to recognize those that came before me and those who are sitting on the commission today and upholding those values and making sure that the spirit of the design guidelines and our community values are embodied in the 2035 plan and the comp plan. I guess I'll just stop there. It was a great time when I was there. It was like living in a crystal ball and seeing the future of Portland. And I have to say, it has come to fruition, and I hope to see it continue into the future. So thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Anyone else, Carla?
That's all.
This is a report. Is there a motion to accept the report?
So moved.
Second.
The motion has been moved and seconded. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Well, thank you for your first ever report to Council. It's hopefully not your last. Hopefully we'll make this an annual exercise. But I really do appreciate the presentation and the report. It really raises some very important issues that hopefully we can address through our revisions to the comp plan or other things, as Chair Milius was suggesting, about design thresholds on a per-project basis. But I think, as Lloyd said, the quality of your work and your high bar that the Mayor Katz asked you to raise has certainly been met, and want to appreciate all of your service and all of the staff, too. Tim Heron, Rebecca Esau, Carly Fiorina? Fioravanti? Okay, I knew I was going to get your last name wrong, but...
And she used to be the head of Hewlett-Packard. Now she's changed her name.
Oh, that's...
Moved to
Is there anybody else from BDS besides? Okay. I want to thank you for all your hard work, too. And you really do, you really are citizens that are the riches of our city. Serving 8-hour meetings and stuff like that is above and beyond the call of duty. So thank you very much. Aye.
Leonard?
I appreciate the work of the Design Commission, having worked with them for a number of years as the commissioner in charge of BDS. But I want to emphasize a couple of the names that Commissioner Saltzman just read. Rebecca Esau has just done an outstanding job overseeing that entire section, and so I want to thank particularly Rebecca and Tim Heron, who is the day-to-day guy up there, and I'm proud to say I had a little something to do with both of them being in the positions they are in. You're doing great work, and I appreciate it. And then especially Paul Scarlett, who has really created an atmosphere at the Bureau of Development Services that allows for really true creativity, and he listens to a variety of different opinions and consistently uses good judgment. And